Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
What you're hearing now is called Green Leaf. It's from the suite Wild Swans. And the woman who wrote this music is my guest for you today. Her name is Elena Katz-Chernin. Elena Katz-Chernin is one of Australia's greatest composers. She was born a long way away in Tashkent, of all places, when it was part of the old Soviet Union. Today, Elena mostly writes music from her beachside home in Sydney, and her work is performed all over the world, and audiences love her work. You would have heard her music, perhaps, at the opening of the Sydney Olympics in 2000, or on Classic FM, or indeed at the start of Philip Adams' Late Night Live. Elena Katz-Chernin is amazingly prolific. There's always new music in her head that she can't wait to put down on paper. And indeed, it seems like Elena's got a bit of a parallel world, like a city of her own music in her mind that she can just slip into whenever she wants to. She may appear to be silently waiting for a bus. In fact, she'll actually be hearing, composing, arranging music in her head without a single word coming out of her. She says that she's just a person who puts dots on paper, but oh, what lovely dots. Elena Katz-Chernin, hello.
Hello, Richard.
Hello. Ever since I met you, I've been wanting to get you on. I've been a fan of yours for years and years, and now here you are. It's so lovely to have you on the program,
Elena. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
As I said, you were born in Tashkent, which is amazingly cool to be able to say that. I mean, we have these exotic images in our head of Tashkent. Is it quite as exotic and as fabulous and as glamorous as we imagined it to be?
I wish I knew, because I was four when we left, and I just remember little huts, you know, little buildings, and we lived in a very tiny little place together with grandparents. It was just kind of extended family situation, and then we left when I was four, because my parents were moved to a place called Yaroslav by the government.
Where's Yaroslav?
Yaroslav is on the Volga River, and it's about 360 kilometers from Moscow, so it's not very far.
Tell me about your parents. What were they doing?
My father was an engineer, and my mother was a doctor, eye doctor. And they needed engineers in Yaroslav. So that's how the country sort of functioned. They just planned for you to go after the university to a certain place to work. So, and they also needed doctors. So both my parents got immediate jobs. And actually, we got an apartment as well. So they actually, it was all government run. So even the apartments were government run. So we got a place to live. And I actually quite remember how we moved into that place. It was right on the river.
I've got a picture of it. I've got two different pictures in my head of this place. Is it one of those places with beautiful sort of golden onion-domed cathedrals, or is it sort of vast acres of grim Soviet apartment blocks?
It's actually exactly what you said, full of those incredible churches with gold crowns, kind of cupoles, we call them. Beautiful places, which some of them were functioning as museums or as settings for films, or just being completely neglected because there was no religion. It was actually atheism taught at schools. And so we used to play in those churches. I remember as kids, we used to just run around there. There was lots of stairs, and they were quite run down, but they were fun, very like caves, you know, that's where you could play.
Is it true that, like, in the Soviet Union at that time, they didn't have Christmas, and you shifted the yearly celebration to New Year's Day, and you got presents on New Year's Day or something? Is that how it worked?
Exactly. We used to get these little packages of like chocolates or nuts and occasional mandarin. I remember that. Mandarin was the biggest thing, because that was very rare to get. And it's true, we had the New Year was connected to the same kind of celebration as here, Christmas.
Was it Father Lennon that brought the presents, or was it someone else? I can't remember.
We did have a Father Frost.
Father Frost?
Yes, that was the character. It's kind of a character in the fairy tales as well. But that was, so in some ways, it was very similar to what Christmas is here, except we had snow. In my childhood, we still had snow.
You started listening to, you didn't talk for a long while, did you, as a little girl? You were quite slow to start speaking. But then when you heard music, then something changed. Tell me about that change.
I was, for some reason, slow in starting to talk. And when I talked, I picked up from my neighbor's child a lot of speech impediments. So I spoke with a lot of letters really wrongly. And somehow, the speech was really not coming out very much at all. And when I was four, and we moved to Yaroslavl, and then my sister started having piano lessons. I heard her take those lessons when she was six. And somehow, when I got home from that lesson, I started playing all the pieces that my sister was playing.
How?
Was supposed to play, actually. How? I wish I knew, because she can remember much more than I can. You know, she just says it was just this.
So you don't remember this is what you've been told of what you did?
Yes, because I can't remember. It was actually quite a... Well, it was because I was about four or four and a half or five. I can't remember this at all.
You were four and you were hearing music on the piano and just... What, playing it? What do you mean, finding it on the keyboard?
Yeah, it was just there. It's like reading an alphabet. I just knew it. It just was kind of a language which was there. And it was... simple. I don't know. It's just, I mean, the pieces weren't amazingly difficult. They were just little da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, just really small. But somehow immediately those letters connected with the notes and with the melody, they made sense to me, much more than words, much more than words. So I don't think I spoke very well, you know, while I already could play the piano.
You know, it's interesting. You say, music, you know, is said to move in cadences, you know, there's a cadence. Yeah. And there's cadence in speech, you know. Music rises and falls.
Yes.
There's music in the way we talk, of course, you know. In my voice, it goes up and down, louder and quiet, and it's in cadence. It's interesting you didn't have that in speech, but bang, there it was in music, right at the get-go. You had it right at the start.
It was a huge relief to my parents and my sister as well, because they were worried that I was a little bit undeveloped. Mm. Yeah. Suddenly this complete change around happened, and I guess they were very happy. I think it was a little bit difficult for my sister. She was really smart, and she still is smart. But I think there suddenly I was with kind of beyond that. I was different. It was just different, you know, different kind of smartness. But I must say, my sister is the person who actually taught me to speak properly. Well, she actually worked with me when she was six. She was incredible. She's the best teacher. So she actually worked on my speech and made me repeat letters constantly after her. And she actually made me lose those impediments, which was great.
Who encouraged you then to learn music? Did you then take formal lessons very quickly at a young age?
Yes, my parents then immediately, of course, noticed that there was this gift, as we say, and they talked to the teacher. And then I got lessons, quite intense actually, because I needed more. I was very fast, so I needed more lessons quicker.
Once you have music theory, you know, you understand the kind of mathematical principles of music. When that came into place, what picture do you have in your head of music then? Do you see it as, or did you start to see it as kind of points on a grid, a kind of a grid in your head, or on a map or something? Can you think of what you used to think of and how you think about it now?
It's hard to go back. I didn't compose immediately. I composed, let's say, 2 years into playing music. But it's true. There is a kind of a grid in the head. I do imagine sort of building blocks. You know, you build upon, you know, block upon block, because there is this intervals between notes, and they kind of visual for me. You know, I connect the manuscript picture with the sound very much. So if I see music written, I can hear it in my head already. So there is this connection of imagining something, seeing it on a page, and listening to it. So
wow.
There's the three.
Is it ever as good when you hear it being performed as opposed to reading it off the page, the picture, the music you're getting in your mind.
Sometimes what's different is the tempo and dynamic level. You know, you can't predict that. You don't know if it's going to be as slow or as fast as you imagine. Even if you say that, let's say I write a piece and I write that tempo, you know, it's, let's say, moderately fast. That is not quite clear. That's why we have metronome markings, of course. But even those can be wrong, you know. And even then, if you, let's say, listen to a piece on the piano, sometimes there is one correct tempo for that piece. But the minute it's arranged for another instrument or for a few instruments, the tempo might actually want to be a little bit slower because you want to give the instruments time to unfold. Let's say violin needs more time to make a sound. You know, you can't just do, you know, on the piano you can just, and it's a sound, you know. It's easy.
I see, there's not so much attack on violin unless you're plucking, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you can, of course you can make sharp, fast sounds, but that's a different kind of note. If you want cantilena, which means like singing note, then you need time to hear it. You need time to make it happen. It's the same as the human voice, you know. It's most beautiful when it's slow and unfolding. You're not not like, you know, staccato, very fast and short.
So there you are, Elena. You're like the Lisa Simpson of Tashkent.
Oh, I like that. Oh, this is good. This is going to stick.
I'm going to bill you with that from now on. The Lisa Simpson of Tashkent. And you're picking up this music. How were your parents about music then for you? Were they the kind of parents that were encouraging, or were they going to say, there's no way I'm going to buy you a piano. Go and study maths or something instead.
Well, not only that. We actually had two pianos.
Oh, you had two? Yeah,
well, my mum was actually, I would like to say musician, but she never really became a musician, but she studied music at the same time as she studied medicine. She was mad about music. My father had violin lessons when he was a child, and he loved music, but he never really pursued it. So both of them were very excited. So there was no problem. It was the opposite. They wanted me to play all day. And anytime any guest came over, there I was, of course, go and play us, you know, Moonlight Sonata, go and do play us this. So that was a little bit annoying. But so you were always a kind of a showpiece,
right,
you know.
Yeah. Little Mozart. Yeah, you know, little Mozart being wheeled out to play something beautiful in front of everyone.
Exactly.
Does that mean, given that I'm guessing you loved it straight away and it became an obsession for you, I suppose, straight away music. Did it crowd out everything else from your young life?
A little bit, yes. I kind of did not really have a childhood like other people in some way. So I did feel a little bit envious of some friends. And a lot of times, let's say I had a few friends, and they would do something after school. And I'd say, oh, what are you doing? Oh, I want, and they say, oh, we're not going to tell you. You're not going to come anyway. You'll never have time. And that's kind of, I must say, that hasn't changed
that's
very
mean.
Much. Yeah, it was mean. I was very upset. As a child, I had lots of those situations where I had to miss out on just fun.
Okay,
you know?
Look, can I just broadcast it? I actually met this woman. There's a reason why she's here, is because I met her at a function, at a gallery function. She's great fun at a party. Invite Elena out to parties, please, if you meet her. She's fun. She's not a boring music nerd, okay? I'll just put that out in the world, okay?
I think I'm just making up.
You're making up now.
That's right.
So people are going, oh, don't invite Elena. You know, she won't come, and she's too much into her music. So what did that mean, though? Did you find a way to let music take over the rest of your studies, for example?
No, we actually had quite tough schooling and a lot of homework. So I think the hardest thing for me, I think, in that time was getting up in the morning because I went to bed really late. So I remember those waking up was torture because I really didn't sleep. As you know, children need more sleep than adults.
Why were you up so late?
Because I had to do all this homework. Because after school I was running I actually had figure skating on top of music. I was running with my, you know, figure skates to the figure skating. Then I ran to this music school, had a piano lesson or a theory lesson or a music history lesson. Then I ran maybe back to ice skating training session. And then I went home and had to do all this homework that I actually had to do for the school.
And when would you start that? What time of night would that be?
Sometimes I got home at 9, and I had to sort of, and I usually just gulped a bun on the way to figure skating. You know, I didn't always have proper dinner, but sometimes I did. My parents were great, I must say. My mum very often came with me, you know, and she stood there at the, you know, figure skating rink and watched me, you know.
Figure skating. Why did you take up figure skating if music is this one big passion? Were you in love with figure skating too, Elena?
Actually, not really, no. I wasn't that good at it. And I must say, it was a bit of a struggle for me. But my mother thought it was a really good thing to do, physical education. And she really wanted us, my sister and me, to be fit. So that was the reason she took us to the figure skating in the first place. Because we were in the fresh air, outdoors, doing exercise, you know, doing something.
Otherwise, you'd spend all your time huddled over a piano.
That's right.
Indoors.
That's right. But it was, of course, quite competitive. And that's where I think it didn't quite excite me, because I didn't want to be competitive in the figure skating field. My competitiveness, that's a hard word, would be rather more in music. So in some ways, I didn't really love it. But I did enjoy, you know, getting ahead. I did enjoy to progress to making a, you know, a turn with that many turns in the air. It was quite fun.
Oh, you can do that, can you?
I can do that. I used to be able to do it, like, you know, a long time ago. But today I can't even imagine how to do it. But, yeah, there was a lot involved. You could, you know, do twists, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's figure skating. You know, there's a lot of movements, a lot of gestures, a lot of rules, actually.
One half of the Torval and Dean of Tashkent, composer Elena Katz-Chernin is with me on Conversation today. What was it like living in the Soviet Union at the time? We talked a little bit about that, but I'm guessing this is the 1970s. We're talking about the Brezhnev era, the era of stagnation. Food in short supply? What do you remember of that time?
Okay, food. Everybody somehow got around. You know, in the shops there wasn't much available. You could always get bread, sugar and flour and milk. So that was the staple food.
Scones all day then.
yeah, sort of. And you could always get potatoes. And so I was actually brought up on potatoes, and I always think that shows, because I still love potatoes. It's funny enough. You learn to be very creative with potatoes. What's really hard is to get meat. Was very difficult, and any vegetables which are not in season, like, you know, you could get beetroot in winter, you know, sometimes, but it was really difficult. You had to be not only creative in food making, you had to be creative where to get it and how to get it, and where, you know, if something was suddenly available, let's say you found out that there was beef available in this shop, there was suddenly this huge queue of people running in and trying to get it. And of course, also, there was this system of giving you that much meat, but then you had to buy a lot of bones and fat on top of it. So,
but you had to buy
that. You had to buy that, because that was something not many people wanted, but then you wouldn't get the other bit of the meat without buying that fat. So that was quite interesting. And I was never a big meat eater in those days anyway, but, you know, when you're kind of there, you don't think about it that much.
You don't know what you're not having, do you?
Exactly. So. You don't think about it. You're happy when you get your cucumbers, which is sometimes difficult to get. You know, you're just very happy to get something new. Occasionally, my father used to go to Moscow for work, and he would bring bananas back. And that was just like a miracle. Or oranges, you know. We would make them last for months. Sometimes I think I would open an orange and split it in bits, you know, in those little bits, and leave a couple of them for the next day. And, you know, and when they even get hard, they were still so precious to us, you know. It was just very different attitude to food. But I think it's a good training.
If you can only get one orange a year, that orange must be like heaven. If you only have one orange a year, that would be perfection, having that one orange, wouldn't it?
Yes, and sometimes I look at an orange here and there's abundance of fruit and vegetables.
Yeah, you don't care.
I do. I sometimes do remember those days where there's one little bit, like one portion
hard.
Of that. Yeah, of this orange was so special. I remember how my sister and I, we used to talk about it, and we used to sort of leave those bits, you know, just next to our pillow, just for the next morning to enjoy. It's
kind of... Now, were you competitive with your sister, given that, you know, there she was. She was getting a piano lesson, and little Elena shows up, and bang, she's streaking ahead. Was it a competitive sisterhood?
Not at all, because my sister, her name is Larissa, she's just an amazing person. She's just so... She's one of those people who have golden heart from the day one. She was just... From beginning of our childhood, she was just my... Just this very loving sister. She would do anything, you know, for to make me happy, or to. So she was actually very proud of me being good at music, and she was always supporting me. She still does. She still supports me.
14, you went to Moscow, going to the big city. Now, everyone was trying to get into Moscow in those days, weren't they, in the Soviet Union? Was that because there was more food and there were just more goods, really, more oranges?
That's actually true in some ways. But no, there was actually the best musical education in the country. So to actually really progress and learn something amazing, training, to get this amazing training of music, you actually had to go to Moscow, or in those days, Leningrad as well, which is now Petersburg, St. Petersburg. You had to go to one of those two. Moscow was nearer to us, and there was this great school called Gnesin Academy, and It was quite hard to get into. They took 15 kids out of 600 into this course that I've applied for. And I was 14. And what it meant is that I had to leave home and live in this hostel for the time of study. And
a bit scary?
I know. I was so excited.
Were you?
I was so excited. Scary just maybe the first day. Once I got in, I was so happy because suddenly I had friends. I had friends who actually accepted me because they were also musicians.
They didn't think you were weird anymore.
No, suddenly I was not this strange person who has this interest. Who, you know, because it's actually quite difficult to be one of a kind. You know, when you grow up in your whole class, you're the only one who is studying music in that, to that extent, you know, to really this thorough extent, to, in depth, you become this sort of weird person. People think, you know, you're not quite, just, you know, like
so there
everyone.
Are more people like me in the world, and here we are in Moscow. Elena Katz-Chernin, composer, is with me at the moment. Was it this time you learnt to, this is an interesting phrase, switch off your ears?
Yes.
And what does that mean?
Well, sometimes, because I like to compose most of the time, sometimes if I hear a lot of noise around me, be it people talking, people, you know, kids screaming, cars, anything outside, I can kind of switch it off in my ears. I can even do that in a concert. That's really bad, isn't it? I can do it in a concert if I hear a piece and it's really boring or it really doesn't do much to me and I think, oh, it didn't go the right way. Like, you know, that's really interesting, but then I would have gone differently. So in my head, I start thinking, that's where I would go. And I switch off and I stop listening, which is really rude. So don't tell anyone. It's really bad.
But, Joe, I'd like to have that ability, you know. Sometimes you just can't escape the music of people like Sting, so you need to be able to switch off your ears. If that's the case, how do you do that? Can you explain how you do that?
I'm sure it's not very healthy, and I'm sure I can't really do it for a very long time. You know, you can do it for for the length of a half a concert. That's terrible. But I can, if it's around me all the time, let's say music can be distracting. So I can do it when I'm writing something that's not so hard. You know, there are pieces that I write that are really challenging and very difficult, and there's orchestra and there's lines to fill out, and you have to think very carefully what you're doing. Then I actually do prefer quiet, but not completely quiet, because completely quiet makes me uncomfortable because I'm not used to it. I was brought up in an urban environment. I was not brought up in landscape, you know, where there's only birds and, you know, just a little bit of cows, you know, and, you know, just nature. That's what not what I know. So I kind of like a little bit of noise outside and people. I like having, you know, people around me. You know, I love the fact that there is life around me.
Is there ever a moment where there's not music in your head? Is if you go to a place where it's quiet, does that relentless, because you are incredibly prolific, does that relentless composing machine within the brain of Elena Katz-Chernin start making music unbidden by you?
Well, I do sleep.
Yeah, and, well, when you're awake then.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's music in dreams too, of course. That's true.
But it's never good.
No.
You know, you always think it's good, but it's never good. Even if you know, people say, oh, I write down this at night because I dreamt it. I've tried that. It's just not working because usually what you dream is never good because you actually have to edit everything, you know, everything you even think. But I don't know if I switch off. I sometimes switch off. I try to because I do have a life. I have family, you know, I have a man, and I do feel like I need to concentrate on that, on them. But my brain, of course, sometimes, my partner sometimes says, you know, he thinks, he can see it in my face that I'm already thinking my piece. He can, and sometimes then
does
I try.
Does he get offended by that?
I think he understands me too well, you know, right. to get offended. Yes. He knows that that's how
that's
I am.
Who you are.
Yeah.
And when you're switching off your ears, you know, I love the fact you can be sitting in a concert hall and having this music come at you, and if it's not that great, you just can go and switch off and then go into your own music. Is it like a little parallel world or something inside you? And it's your own music you're going into then when you do that.
That's right. Mostly it's my own music. And occasionally, of course, I occasionally, you know, work with, let's say, a Schubert piece or a Bach piece occasionally. So I actually like to, let's say, latch on to a piece of music from another century and then see where it takes me, because what I like those sort of games. But otherwise, it is a kind of parallel world that's sort of in that head.
So you can be sitting in a boring Haydn concert and be hearing Schubert while all that's going on in front of you.
I can do that well, yeah. So it's actually a double parallel world, isn't it? That's true.
So you need the other music to latch onto to get to shut off your ears then?
Sometimes if I play a piece of Bach, let's say, I can actually close down my own kind of fountain, but not badly, you know, in a good way. So I can open another fountain.
Close down your fountain. That's an interesting analogy. Such the music literally gushing in the mind of Elena Katz-Chernin.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest in conversation today is composer Elena Katz-Chernin. Now, you conducting that little bit of music there with Jack's voice there. Did you could hear how that was flowing, Elena?
Yeah, it's beautiful strings. Yeah, very kind of luscious. I like that.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it. Elena, you were studying in Moscow. You're doing really well. Trained at that incredibly rigorous academy. But your tuition there was cut short by your parents' decision to leave the Soviet Union. How did that come about?
Well, my father had a sister, and she, right after the Second World War, got married to a man from Poland. She went to Poland, lived in Krakow, was a concert pianist, and she still plays her Steinway. And somehow they left Poland when there was unrest and, you know, the conflict, and they decided to go to Australia. So they were in Australia since the 60s. And my Auntie Maya, kept telling my father, my English is still not perfect, that we should come, or at least he should come and visit Australia, Sydney, where they lived. And my father tried to organize the paperwork, but somehow he wasn't permitted to go.
Did the fact that he wanted to come, because he was an engineer.
Yes.
And I'm sure being an engineer, there would have been security issues the time. And the fact that he wanted to leave, did that then make him, a suspicious character as far as the KGB was concerned?
Not yet, because he was just wanting to go for a visit. He wasn't taking the whole family. He was just basically wanted to visit
his
sister.
See, I'm being sister. The KG officer, KGB but, officer now going, yeah, sure, visit. That's, I'm sure.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But it's true, because of the sites, construction sites and security there, because he was working on many construction sites in different places, they decided not to let him go. So my father then said, okay, that's really too bad. And just around that time, there was already a wave of migration from Russia. Solzhenitsyn just left.
There's a lot of your family were Jewish, and there's a lot of Jewish migration too, wasn't there?
Yes, very much.
You know,
yeah.
Like Andrei Sakharov, names have just escaped me at the moment as well. But was that part of it as well?
It was part of it. They actually started this wave, and we kind of, we were part of that wave, but a bit later. So for us, it took another 2 years to actually leave the country.
How did you feel about that? Leaving everything, this academy where you were working very hard but very happy. How did you feel about the idea of coming to Australia? You were 17 or something?
Yeah, I was 17. And I must say, the very last day before we left, I actually went to say goodbye to all my friends. I was very sad to leave. I was sad to leave the study and the friends. So because, you know, you may never come back. And actually, I never did. I have never been back.
You've never been back?
No, never. So it's kind of leaving your, you know, you're leaving your youth, your life, your childhood, everything behind. You're starting a new life. I didn't know what that was going to be, but I'm very happy we did.
Now, the thought has just occurred to me that being a Soviet Russian person, as you were at the time, you must have viewed Australia the same way we'd viewed Tashkent, I suppose, as an impossibly exotic, faraway place.
Absolutely.
What did you think you were coming to when you...
I thought I was coming to koalas and kangaroos,
of course.
Because
flights with corks around their heads. And,
because we had the photos, I mean, we had the postcards from my my auntie and my cousins, which were all these beautiful pictures of the wildlife and, of course, the Sydney Opera House. That was kind of our Bible shot. And then, of course, beautiful pictures of my cousins and the auntie and uncle, who always looked so beautiful and so happy. And so, you know, and the photos were so nice. It was this sort of life, charmed life, you know, we thought we were going to come to, which in some ways it is. It is, you know.
Your first job here was working in a milk bar.
Yes.
How'd you go?
My uncle knew someone who had a milk bar in the Australia Square in the middle of Sydney City. And I didn't go so well because I didn't speak very good English, and I didn't know some words. I remember my first word that I got confused was garbage. They said, put this in the garbage, and I said, what's that? And I remember they showed me very, very quickly how to make a hamburger, and I didn't quite get what hamburger is. I've never in my life had a hamburger. You know, it was one of the first weeks we were in Sydney. I never had hot chips. You know, all those things we never had. Or sandwiches. I didn't know. We never had bread that form, you know, the square form. We had bread like bread loaves, you know, sort of round. So everything was really new. The Vegemite I never had in my life, you know, all sorts of things. So I think there was one person I sold a hamburger to. I think that was just once. And I think I sold them a frozen hamburger. Oh, they'll forgive me. And I think from there on, I was banned into just washing the dishes, which I was very good at.
But you quickly then set an entrance exam at the Conservatorium of Music in Sydney, and you got in. That must have been a completely different experience to the Moscow Academy, I'm guessing, because you would have been introduced, you probably wouldn't have had the rigorous discipline of Moscow, but there would have been newer forms of music that would have been considered decadent.
Exactly. There was a lot of things. First of all, you were more left to your devices, like your own. You had to make up your own timetable in Gnesin Academy. Everything was just written. You just went where you were told to go. You had the whole timetable was printed on the wall, and you knew what to do when, because everything was completely systematically, you know, it really worked out.
How did you adjust to that, Elena?
To be independent was very difficult. Suddenly to be free person and to decide yourself, do I want to do this elective study? Do I know if I want to do it? I was quite lost at first. You know, I didn't know what is this subject. I've never heard of it. You know, there's names for some subjects that I didn't even know. What was great is I had immediately some friends, you know, at the school, and they helped me. You know, they said, oh, this is, you really don't need to do this. You may want to do this because you've already studied it in Russia. Maybe, you know, so I was given a little bit of guidance.
You had a mentor, Richard Toop. How did he help you?
He arrived in Sydney to teach at the conservatorium a year later than I actually already studied. So by that time, I enrolled in the piano course. So I was studying piano as main subject because I wasn't even yet clear that I wanted to study composition. I just wanted to study it, but on the side, you know, as an extra lessons. And then when Richard came on board, I think by that time, I have actually applied for a composition course and had kind of a double study major. And he heard a concert where I presented a piece. And there was a really funny piece.
A piece of your own?
Piece of my own. And this is, and you asked me before how different it was about music, how music was different in Sydney. at the conservatorium as opposed to Moscow, we had suddenly this incredible avant-gardistic tendencies in Sydney. You know, you could hear music that was played on, let's say, sounds just on the table or sounds made with pencils or electronic sounds. And it was much more open. You could try experimental things. So I did a piece where I think I was playing mouth organ, just clusters. You know, I couldn't play it.
So mouth organ, right?
Yeah, just mouth organ. Yeah. Somebody, and I was playing piano in the, with the left hand, and I had an oboe player playing, you know, student playing with me. And Richard really liked that piece because it was completely mathematically worked out, and he really thought that I had a, you know, talent for the new music. And so he said, would you like to have lessons with me? Because at the time I had occasional lessons, but not proper composition teacher. And I said, yeah, I would love to. And so Richard showed me this incredible music world out there, which was existing in Europe at the time, because he just came from Europe after working with this incredibly hard modernist composer, basically the hero of the, I think, 20th century of music, Karlheinz Stockhausen. He was his assistant. And he, Richard, we called him the walking encyclopedia because he just knew everything.
Your music couldn't be more different from Stockhausen. I mean, it's so much more emotional, I suppose.
Well, it's changed, you know, because we change.
Yeah.
So once I've come, well, so cut the story short, he was the one who suggested that I go overseas to study after finishing the conservatorium. And so he was mentor in many ways, but also in that I go overseas and study. So I went to Germany.
You went to Germany. And how did your life change once you went to Germany for some years?
Well, it changed a lot because I actually then got married and had three children while there. But also I studied with Lachenmann. That was quite a difficult study because, again, I had to learn another language again. So I had to learn German. Lessons were in German, and Lachenmann spoke quite complex philosophical language. Used Adorno termination, which is... termination is the wrong word. Terminology. Terminology. And it was quite difficult to understand sometimes what he meant, but he was actually a very good teacher. And then I stayed in Germany for 14 years, imagine. I never thought I would stay there that long. But what happened is after my study with Lachenmann, I decided I wasn't so interested in writing that sort of music. You see, that's when the switch happened from this hard modernism to something different. And how that happened is because I went to work in the theatre. I worked a lot with drama directors and also ballet, the dance world.
You love composing for ballet, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Why ballet specifically?
Well, ballet, because it's, first of all, it's just a little bit like silent film. Ballet and silent film are those two mediums which don't have words and don't have anything interfering with the music. So you are free to do a lot. At the same time, of course, you have to enhance the performance. You have to collaborate with what you see on stage or on film. You can't do too much in the music, so you learn to step back. So you learn to be modest, which is really important for a composer. I think it's important to be both modest and also forward. You have to have both sides to you. You know, you've got to be able to be small, but then also to be able to say, yes, I'm actually really great, you know, which is really hard because sometimes the doubts are really big, you know. You don't always love what you do. But it's nice to see the movements of people because I think the movements of dancers give me the impetus for the piece.
Is it pictures as well? Because I wonder, because I've got some beautiful pieces here by you, which I'm not going to get time to play. I'm just enjoying talking to you so much. One is called like Second Door on the Left and Green Leaf, and there and a reference to someone's painting. They're often very visual titles. Do you like to have a picture rather than a feeling to work from
both.
In your mind?
Yeah, because both. Because even the picture has a feeling, I find. I think I see something, but I see beyond what I see, or that actually changes according to the day, according to how I feel. So I have paintings hanging on my walls, and unlike a lot of people who keep changing their paintings, once they are on the wall, they stay on the wall, you know, for years. So I keep looking at the same painting every time I write a piece. And I try to see something different every time in it. I get very inspired by the movement in it or the way the sun falls on it. But at the same time, I find, is it today a positive energy painting or today is it a bit darker? You know, it's both. But also sometimes the emotional behind the piece I want to write plus the painting also does something.
Elena Katz-Chernin, composer, is my guest in conversation. You're well known also for that fantastic theme you wrote to Philip Adams' program, Late Night Live, which I think he's just changed for some reason. I'm not quite sure why, but we'll put that to one side for the moment. But there's always this bit of, even though you're from, like, you know, East Russia, and then Far East, if you like, from originally Tashkent, there's always a little bit of Central Europe. Well, not always, but often there's a bit of Central Europe in your music. Something that sounds like it's coming out of a Hungarian cafe. Is that from your time in Germany? Is that what? Yeah, and that seems to be quite. I don't know. There's a Jewish flavour in there, like the Jewish Central Europe. Am I reading too much into this, Elena? I don't know.
I don't know myself because I don't go to cafes in Europe that much. You know, and it's a feeling because there is not necessarily music running. And a lot of times when you do have music in the cafes today, it's pop music or. You know, music from, it could be classical, actually. A lot of times, if you're in Austria, it's actually, you know, it could be Mozart. You know, you just don't know.
Yeah, not in Prague or Budapest, though, or places like that.
Yeah, where I actually haven't been. But yes, you're right. Somehow, it's probably the flair from the what I've seen in films, maybe, and I've seen the sort of cafe and atmosphere. You know, there could be, because I'm quite, how would you say it? I do get inspired by what I see sometimes around me. It could be a film, and I see a cafe scene, and I heard something, and I think, oh, that I don't actually think that's true. That's a lie. I don't think. It's just something that just drops a penny into my head. You know, it just drops this melody or something, and I can't get out of it. So the only way to get rid of it is to change it and do something maybe similar. But you know what I mean? It's like it is a bit obsessive, actually. I don't know.
Well, you came back to Australia after that time in Germany. And was that hard for you then? I suppose Germany is a great place to launch yourself, I suppose, and become internationally famous, which you have done to some degree. Was it then a bit awkward for you to come back to Australia? Tell me what that was like and how you then made your life all about composition once you came back to Australia.
Well, it actually was great for me to come back. I wanted to come back for many, many years, but I just couldn't. You know, they always think, that's not a good time for the school, for this child, or not good for that particular child. Or, you know, you think, that's not a good age yet, not a good time. And at some point, it was just around when my father was dying, and he said, you know, and my mom used to always say, come back, we miss you. And my sister kept saying that, and I saw how my sister's children got on with my children. I thought they were really, it would be really good for them to be with their cousins. And then on my father's almost deathbed, just 10 days before he died, he said, you know what, you don't have to come back if you don't want to, or if you don't really feel like you really have to. And that was the moment I said, yes, I have to come back. You know, the minute I was suddenly free to make my own decision and to say, okay, I actually have to come back now before it's too late. And so my father passed away in 93, and in 94 we came back. It was exactly a year. I gave myself a year to arrive exactly to a year after his passing, and we started a new life. And the one thing musically for me was that I was not anymore connected to any theatre. I could do my own work. I actually could do concert pieces again, you know, which I haven't done for a long time. Until.
So that meant you were, I suppose, free, but poor but free, I suppose.
Very poor but free.
What were you living off? How did you get by?
Well, my mum always made me dinners. And my children, my sister used to feed us. We somehow, I don't know, I had a lot of help. I had some savings from Germany, but they were dwindling. You know, everything was kind of going away.
But then things took off, didn't they? Pretty quickly for you.
Yes.
Your work was picked up in Australia and performed very quickly, Elena.
Yes, I don't know how that happened, but in the first year I had one or two commissions. They were very small. Then for a year I taught at the Conservatorium. For a year I taught composition. And then I got, for some reason, I think I got the silent movie soundtrack commission from Germany, from German television. And that was in 95. Or 96, around then. And also I got somehow my piece called Clocks, ACO's Richard Tonetti got hold of it and decided to play it in the festival, Huntington Festival. And again, so he kind of made me known in that sort of setting in Huntington. Then that piece got picked up by someone else and another group called Sydney Alpha Ensemble, and so it just went. You know, it's like this. It just exponentially kind of grows. It just grows.
So now you sit in your beachside apartment in Sydney, close to the beach, and you've got a nice spot there where you can write music all the time. Is it true to say? I mean, I think sometimes people mistake creating art for therapy, and it's not. You know, it shouldn't really be seen that way because it's not really about to be healing. Art isn't, is it? But nonetheless, does it make you happy?
Yes. Funny, because somebody the other day asked me a question: do you enjoy it? And I kind of gave the answer, which I'm not sure if it's right. I said, it's hard work. It's of course it's enjoyable when it's flowing, but you can't just say it's enjoying, like enjoying an ice cream or enjoying. I said it's not relaxing. It's just not relaxing because you actually do sit all day in front of the music paper. You've got to write relentlessly, especially if it's an orchestra piece. It's huge. But I do love it. Of course I love it. I can't imagine doing anything else. And
can there be any art without struggle then, I wonder? Because if you don't have struggle, then the work won't have tension and it won't have the kind of electricity it needs to communicate itself.
Yeah, I think struggle sometimes, you know, honestly, there is no reason, there is no rule, there is no system. Some pieces just jump right out of me, you know, they just in a matter of a couple of hours, I've got this idea, and in a matter of a few days, I've got the piece. Because it takes a longer time a little bit to actually get the piece out on the paper. But sometimes some pieces for 3 days or 4 days, I just have nothing. It's like empty block. And it's not even a block because I never have blocks. I write every...
You don't.
No, I write all the time. It's just that I call it a block if I don't have anything good coming out. Because you do have your self-critical kind of devices where you say, oh, that's not good enough. That's not strong enough for a piece. So you constantly, not struggle, but you discuss with yourself constantly, is this good? Is this going to hold for a whole piece? Or is it just a bit weak? You know, you've got to constantly criticize yourself. So that's the struggle, to let through something. You know, you almost say to yourself, ah, come on, Elena, don't be so hard on yourself. Get it out. It's okay. It's not bad. But not bad is not a good word. Actually, it's two words. But it's actually not good enough. It has to be exceptionally good, you know.
Elena, the composer, has to get past Elena, the gatekeeper. The Elena in quality control is going to go, what's this bit of old rubbish here? I don't fancy this. No, send that back. Elena, I want to go back by playing a bit of your music, and there's a story behind it. It's a piece you've written called Village Idiot, and it comes about in some ways because of your son Alex, who has schizophrenia. Can you tell me the story behind this piece?
Okay, well, he was in 1998, when he was actually only 14, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
14, that's quite young, isn't it?
It is very young. And so the brain obviously is not formed at that point. It's still fluid and all the hormones playing up. And it's a tough time for any teenage boy. So if you have mental illness, then it's it's devastating. It's a tragedy. And it's scary because it's always on the verge of big tragedy. You know, he was sometimes gone, escaping from the hospital. You know, there was a lot of upheaval in that time when he first got diagnosed, and we had great doctors, great care along the way, but it is hard, very hard to treat, you know, very difficult and still very difficult, and he's now 27, just turned 27, so he's a big boy now, he's a man now, you know, so it's a very devastating illness. Around 2006, there was an exhibition called For Matthew and Others. It was an exhibition to do with paintings by either schizophrenic painters or about schizophrenia, and actually some work of my son was exhibited at the Campbelltown galleries, as well as at Penrith Performing Arts Centre. And at the time of the launch, I wrote a piece of music, and then there was other performers, other artists, and one of them was called Graham Doyle, who presented a poem of his called The Village Idiot. It was about how, being different in the society. And it was really inspiring. And the poem itself and the man himself, he was also a painter. And his works were also on the walls at the Performing Arts Centre in Penrith. And I felt compelled to write a piece called Village Idiot. I had a commission at the time to write it for a group called Present Music in the USA in Milwaukee.
And part of it comes from you meditating about silence. I mean, I suppose some people who have schizophrenia will really long for silence.
Exactly, because what happens, of course, there is voices in your heads and they're constant and they're not orderly. They're not like one voice. There could be a whole lot of voices going all at the same time, but chaotically and saying all different things, usually not nice things. So it's probably very scary.
I wonder too, it makes me just think, I hate to play armchair psychiatrist in this case, but you talk about your fountain, if you like, of music. I wonder if it's not that dissimilar to something like, it's just a more orderly and aesthetic and lovely form of...
Yeah, it's just one thing, of course, is an illness and the other is a gift, you know.
Is really fine, isn't it?
Possibly, except, of course, I just enjoy what I have. My fountain is great, you know, it's lovely, it's beautiful, it's great to have music running into my head. It can be distracting, but it's nothing like the tragedy that a person who has schizophrenia goes through.
I'm going to play a bit of it now. This is Village Idiot from Elena Katz-Chernin, and... Gee, it's been great to talk to you, Elena.
Thank you
so much for being my guest in conversation.
And thank you. It was great.
It's composer Elena Katz-Chernin. This is just a little bit of Village Idiot, the music that was inspired by that poem.
Listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.